I'm your brother Fire Mary Diesel Ogaya, and welcome to the Class War Battlefield Podcast. When I started this show in 2011, my goal was to inform. Obviously, the show has evolved, a lot of new topics, a lot of new thoughts, taking on metaphysics, some spirituality, hitting you with all types of things that you may have never heard of, and some that you have. It's always lively. But now I'm coming to you to ask you to help me prolong this podcast. For years, I have been producing this podcast for free on your behalf. I am now coming to you to ask you to support this work. $2, $5, $10, $20, $50, whatever you can do, please do.
And now,
the definition.
My fellow Americans, when I ran for president, I was told the days of bipartisanship were over, and that Democrats and Republicans could no longer work together. But I refused to believe that, because America can never give in to that way of thinking. Look, the only way American democracy can function is through compromise and consensus. And that's what I worked to do as your president. You know, to forge bipartisan agreement where it's possible and where it's needed. I've signed more than 350 bipartisan laws thus far, almost 2.5 years, including a historic law that rebuilding America so that we can rank number one in the world in infrastructure instead of where we're ranked now, number 13 in the world. Another historic law, rebuilding our manufacturing base so that we'll lead the world once again in making semiconductor chips. So much more, and so many more sophisticated ones. And now, a bipartisan budget agreement. This is vital because it's essential to the progress we've made over the last few years is keeping full faith and credit of the United States of America and passing a budget that continues to grow our economy and reflects our values as a nation. That's why I'm speaking to you tonight, to report on the crisis averted and what we're doing to protect America's future. Passing this budget agreement was critical. The stakes could not have been higher. If we had failed to reach an agreement on the budget, there were extreme voices threatening to take America for the first time in our 247-year history. Nothing would have been more catastrophic. Our economy would have been thrown into recession. Retirement accounts for millions of Americans would have been decimated. 8 million Americans would have lost their jobs. Default would have destroyed our nation's credit rating, which would have made everything from mortgages to car loans to funding for the government much more expensive. And it would have taken years to climb out of that hole. And America's standing as the most trusted, reliable financial partner in the world would have been shattered. So it was critical to reach an agreement. And it's very good news for the American people. No one got everything they wanted, but the American people got what they needed. We averted an economic crisis, an economic collapse. We're cutting spending and bringing the deficits down at the same time. We're protecting important priorities from Social Security to Medicare to Medicaid to veterans to our transformational investments in infrastructure and clean energy. I want to commend Senator Speaker McCarthy. You know, he and I and our teams, we were able to get along, get things done. We were straightforward with one another, completely honest with one another, respectful with one another. Both sides operated in good faith. Both sides kept their word. And I also want to commend other congressional leaders, House Minority Leader Jeffries, Senate Majority Leader Schumer, Senate Minority Leader McConnell. They acted responsibly and put the good of the country ahead of politics. The final vote in both chambers was overwhelming, far more bipartisan than anyone thought was possible. So, I want to thank the members of Congress who voted to pass this agreement, which I'm going to sign tomorrow and become the law. So here's what the deal does. First, it cuts spending. And over the next 10 years, the deficit will be cut by more than $1 trillion. That will be on top of the record $1.7 trillion I already cut the deficit in my first 2 years in office. And it's clear we're all on a much more fiscally responsible course than the one I inherited when I took office 4 years ago. When I came to office, the deficit had increased every year the previous 4 years, and nearly $8 trillion was added to the national debt in the last administration. And now we're turning things around, and that's good for America. You know, my dad used to have an expression. He said, "Joey, don't tell me what you value. Show me your budget. I'll tell you what you value." That's at the heart of this debate. What do we value? Protecting seniors. You may remember during my State of the Union address, there was a spirit exchange between me and a few Republicans spontaneously occurring on the floor of the House of Representatives. I was pointing out that for years, some of them were putting forward proposals to cut Social Security and Medicare. And some of them that night took exception, and they said very loudly that that wasn't true. So I asked them on the floor at that night, I said, ask them a simple question. Will you agree not to cut Social Security, not to cut Medicare? Would they agree to protect these essential programs? They're a lifeline for millions of Americans. Programs that these Americans have been paying into every single paycheck they've earned since they started working. And that provides so much peace of mind. With the bright lights and cameras on, those few Republicans who were protesting, they agreed. They said they wouldn't cut it. That's how we protected Social Security and Medicare from the beginning and from it being cut, period. Healthcare was another priority for me, a top priority. I made it clear from the outset, I would not agree to any cuts in Medicaid, another essential lifeline for millions of Americans, including children in poverty, the elderly in nursing homes, and Americans living with disabilities. The original House Republican proposal would have cut health care for up to 21 million Americans on Medicaid. And I said no. And Medicare was protected. And so were millions of people most in need. Look, I've long believed that the only one truly sacred obligation that the government has is to prepare those we send into harm's way and care for them and their families when they come home and when they don't come home. That's why my last budget provided VA hospitals with additional funding for more doctors, nurses, and equipment to accommodate the needs of veterans and more appointments. The House Republican plan would have met 30 fewer million VA healthcare visits for our veterans. But we didn't let that happen. In addition, this bill fully funds the bipartisan PACT Act, the most significant law in decades for veterans exposed to toxic burn pits and for their families. It expands access to those veterans and their families to health care and to disability benefits. Look, we're investing in America and our people and in our future. We've created over 13 million new jobs, nearly 800,000 manufacturing jobs. Where is it written that America can't lead the world again in manufacturing? Unemployment is at 3.7%. More Americans are working today than ever in the history of this country. And inflation has dropped 10 straight months in a row. In this debate, I refuse to put what was responsible for all this economic progress on the chopping block. This bipartisan agreement protects the law that will help us build the best infrastructure in the world. It fully protects the CHIPS and Science Act, which is going to bring key parts of our supply chain to America, so we don't have to rely on others, like semiconductors. Those tiny computer chips, smaller than the tip of your finger, that affect nearly everything we rely on, from cell phones to building automobiles to the most sophisticated weapon systems and so much more. We protected another law that I passed and signed last year that finally beat Big Pharma, which I've been trying to do for over 30 years. It finally gives Medicare the power to negotiate lower drug prices, just like the VA has been able to do for veterans. This law has already dramatically cut the cost of insulin for seniors from as much as $400 a month to just $35 a month for insulin. Negotiating lower drug prices not only saves seniors a lot of money, it saves the country a lot of money, $160 billion that's not having to be paid out because drug prices are more rational. We pay the highest drug prices of any industrial nation in the world, and it's just the beginning. You know, we also protected the most significant breakthrough ever in dealing with the existential threat of climate change. Today, new wind and solar power is cheaper than fossil fuel. Since I've been in office, clean energy and advanced manufacturing have brought in $470 billion in private investments. It's going to create thousands of jobs, good-paying jobs, all across this country, and help the environment at the same time. Remember, at the beginning of this debate, some of my Republican colleagues were determined to gut the clean energy investments. I said, no, we kept them all. And there's so much more to do. We're going to do even more to reduce the deficit. We need to control spending if we're going to do that. But we also have to raise revenue and go after tax cheats and make sure everybody's paying their fair share. No one, I promise, no one making less than $400,000 a year will pay a penny more in federal taxes. But like most of you at home, I know the federal tax system isn't fair. That's why I kept my commitment, again, that no one earning less than $400,000 a year will pay a penny more in federal taxes. That's why last year I secured more funding to go, more IRS funding to go after wealthy tax cheats. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, and it is nonpartisan, says that this bill will bring in $150 billion, and other outside experts expect that it would save as much as $400 billion, because it's forcing people to pay their fair share. Republicans may not like it, but I'm going to make sure the wealthy pay their fair share. I'm also proposed closing over a dozen special interest tax loopholes for big oil, crypto traders, hedge fund billionaires, saving taxpayers billions of dollars. Republicans defended every single one of these special interest loopholes, every single one. But I'm going to be coming back, and with your help, I'm going to win. Right now, catch this, right now the average billionaire in America pays just 8% in federal taxes, 8%. Teachers and firefighters pay more than that. That's why I proposed the minimum tax for billionaires. Republicans are against it, but I'm going to keep fighting for it. No billionaire should pay less in federal taxes than a teacher or a firefighter. Look, let me close with this. I know bipartisanship is hard, and unity is hard, but we can never stop trying. Because in moments like this one, the ones we just faced, where the American economy and the world economy is at risk of collapsing, there's no other way. No matter how tough our politics gets, we need to see each other, not as adversaries, but as fellow Americans. Treat each other with dignity and respect. To join forces as Americans to stop shouting, lower the temperature, and work together to pursue progress, secure prosperity, and keep the promise of America for everybody. As I've said in my inaugural address, without unity, there is no peace, only bitterness and fury. And we can never become that country. I can honestly say to you tonight that I've never been more optimistic about America's future. We just need to remember who we are. We are the United States of America. And there's nothing we can't do when we do it together.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Joe Biden has signed a debt ceiling deal into law that averts a historic default by the United States. In his first address from the Oval Office, Biden said passing this budget agreement was critical.
American democracy can function is through compromise and consensus. And that's what I work to do as your president. You know, to forge bipartisan agreement where it's possible and where it's needed.
Progressives who oppose the bipartisan deal cited new cuts it imposes on key social programs and expanded work requirements for some recipients of food stamps. The legislation was called a dirty deal by climate activists because it rolls back the National Environmental Policy Act and fast-tracks the approval and construction of the frack gas Mountain Valley Pipeline through West Virginia and Virginia, a pet project of the powerful conservative Democratic West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin. Meanwhile, critics say lobbyists prevented the debt bill from including tax reforms and repealing high income tax cuts. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders, who voted no, spoke Saturday at a rally to raise the wage in Charleston, South Carolina.
In this moment in American history, we have a choice. Either we abdicate our responsibilities to our kids and future generations, and we allow a handful of billionaires to consolidate their wealth and their power, or we stand up and fight back.
For more, we're joined in Denver, Colorado, by David Sirota, award-winning investigative journalist, founder of the news website The Lever, where his latest piece is headlined, "This is what Biden says is a big win." Sirota is also editor-at-large for Jacobin. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, David. Okay, can you just lay out who you think gained and lost in this historic debt signing deal? Historic because it would have been the first time, if it hadn't been signed, that the country defaulted.
Well, certainly the fossil fuel industry is a big winner here, as you alluded to with the Mountain Valley Pipeline, expediting that controversial pipeline, which many say will be a climate bomb at a time of a climate emergency. So the fossil fuel industry, a huge winner here. Defense contractors, military contractors, also a big winners in this deal, in which it approved the Pentagon budget going up to another record level. Private student lenders who have wanted the end of the private student lending moratorium, they are big winners here. They have been lobbying for that. One major private student lender, its stock began rising as soon as this deal was being finalized. And then, of course, the very rich. Again, as you alluded to, there were no measures in this debt bill to repeal the high-income tax cuts that are responsible, primarily responsible, for the increase in the debt ratio that was supposed to be at issue in this bill. In fact, in addition to not repealing those high-income tax cuts, the bill also cuts a large amount of funding from the IRS. And the IRS is specifically its functions to enforce the basic tax laws already on the books as they relate to the very wealthy. We have a very big situation in this country where hundreds of billions of dollars of owed taxes go unpaid by the richest Americans. That funding was supposed to be to do that kind of crackdown. Now it has been moved out into other programs. So those are the big winners in this bill.
The losers.
Well, the losers are everybody else. The losers, in particular, very, very poor people. As you discussed, the changes to the food stamp program to make it harder for lots of people to access food stamps at a time of an affordability crisis. That's a big loss. I think student debtors, where again, in the middle of an affordability crisis, you've got student debt payments that are going to start up again. So basically, the working class of this country was deeply harmed by this bill. And I would say this, the president celebrating this bill as a big win. In other words, instead of saying this is something that we had to do, and we can go over whether he actually had to do it, he didn't have to do this. But instead of saying we had to do this, it's kind of unfortunate, going out and celebrating this as a big win is an admission about what the Democratic president and the Democratic Party see as a win and for whom they think they want to secure such victories. It's all now out on the table. It's all now there for everybody to see. And it's important to remember that we didn't have to be at this point. The Democratic Party controlled both houses of Congress in the lame duck and chose not to pass a clean debt ceiling bill. They chose not to. At the time, Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois simply said the party did not feel like making time at the end of the congressional session to do that. So the point being is, this is exactly the result that the Democratic Party wanted. They wanted to work with Republicans to get to these exact policies, and now they are celebrating that. So I think we all need to take a moment to say, okay, this is what the Democratic president and the Democratic Party, working alongside the Republican Party, this is what it actually wants.
So, obviously, you agree that if the U.S. had defaulted, it would have created an absolute catastrophe. But you say, aside from even having negotiated the deal on the lame duck when the Democrats were in control, that Biden had this option of the 14th Amendment and didn't take it. Talk about the significance of that.
Sure. The Constitution makes pretty clear that the U.S. government is empowered above statutes, if you will, to deal with the debt and make sure it does not default on its debt. Progressive lawmakers had asked the Biden administration to use this power to avert this entire manufactured crisis. And almost as soon as that proposal was floated by those lawmakers, the Biden White House said no, they're not even going to pursue it. And again, I think you put that together with the fact that they didn't try to pass a clean debt ceiling bill during the lame duck session when Democrats controlled the Congress. And what you see is a picture of a party that wanted this outcome. Overlay it, by the way, with one other layer, with the fact that Joe Biden, throughout his career, has given floor speeches on the floor of the Senate, has made clear that he wants to work with Republicans to cut spending, cut funding for social programs. So I think we have to step back and realize this is a moment of honesty, a moment of clarity of where at least the leadership of the Democratic Party is when it comes to things like budget austerity.
Let me ask you about your piece on Republican presidential hopeful Ron DeSantis, right, the Florida governor. Headline, Florida lawmakers help DeSantis shovel more cash to Wall Street, in which you report how DeSantis's fundraising for his 2024 presidential bid could be hindered by a federal pay-to-play rule that restricts campaign contributions from financial executives to state officials who control pension investment decisions. Explain.
Ron DeSantis, as the governor, is one of three people who control Florida's massive public employee pension system. About 10, 15 years ago, an anti-corruption law was passed in the wake of corruption scandals at pension systems, which said basically that the financial managers who are given money to manage by public officials, to manage those monies on behalf of retirees, they cannot give money to politicians who control that money, because the decisions about who gets to invest those monies need to be made based purely on merit, not on political influence. As we report at The Lever, and folks can find at levernews.com, our story shows that under DeSantis, Florida pension money was moved to various financial firms whose executives were giving money to political groups that ultimately ended up boosting Ron DeSantis's political campaigns. Now, there's a question about whether they used intermediary groups to try to get around that very clear anti-corruption law. But moving forward, as DeSantis tries to raise money for his presidential campaign, this anti-corruption law is there to make sure that financial managers benefiting from his decisions and how he apportions the retirement funding for teachers, firefighters, other public employees, that rule is there to try to make sure that he doesn't use that leverage. He's not able to use that leverage to raise money from the financial firms that could get that money and earn big fees off that money. So it could provide a very serious obstacle for DeSantis to raise lots of money if the law, and it's a big if that law is enforced.
You say this isn't a theoretical problem. About a decade ago, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who's running again, throwing his hat in the ring for president this week, as well as Texas Governor Rick Perry, both faced the same fundraising obstacle with their own GOP presidential campaigns. Quoting a Christie top advisor, admitting there is no way around it. There are no loopholes.
Yeah. It's a very, very clear law. And let's be clear about how it works. It's designed to deter the financial managers from giving the money, because the financial managers are the ones who can get punished. If you give money, if you're a giant private equity firm and you give money to your executives, give money to Ron DeSantis, and the Florida pension fund is giving you money to manage, the law can basically say you can't manage that money anymore. So it creates a financial deterrent to Wall Street firms to engage in that kind of financial fundraising for political candidates. So, yes, it could be a huge obstacle for DeSantis. But again, I go back to the if. Will the Biden administration's Securities and Exchange Commission actually enforce this law? Will the law actually be taken seriously by regulators? Will the law be applied to super PACs, some of which seem designed to get around these kinds of laws? That's the big question for campaign finance here right now.
And finally, David Sirota, as many Republican presidential candidates throw their hat in the ring, from South Carolina's Tim Scott, as well as Nikki Haley, to Chris Christie, to the North Carolina, to the North Dakota governor, and of course DeSantis. If you can talk about, and Vice President Pence this week, what you're watching.
Well, look, I think the Republican primary is going to be essentially an arms race for how extreme each candidate can try to position themselves. They're going to be in a battle to show who's more extreme on immigration, who's more extreme on budget cutting, who's more extreme on trying to push for larger Pentagon budgets and the like. So I think watching that and seeing how extreme it gets is going to be important. I also think on the Democratic side, seeing whether the party is going to pursue an agenda which says we are a party that is going to deliver for the working class, or whether the party is going to try to position itself in much the way you heard Joe Biden starting to try to position himself as a quote unquote bipartisan conciliator. My view is that the Democratic Party has a very, very serious risk in this election if it is not constantly showing that it is delivering for the working class. If it is trying to only show that it wants to work with Republicans instead of saying our agenda is to deliver real material gains for the working class. If the party's agenda is not that, if it is more of a bipartisan conciliation message, I think that puts at risk in a very real way the 2024 election.
David Sirota, award-winning investigative journalist and founder of the news website The Lever. We'll link to your pieces. This is what Biden says is a big win, as well as your piece on Ron DeSantis and Wall Street.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your brother Vladimir Deese. Oh, Gaia. Welcome to this not special, but sort of special. And you see the number. Episode of the Class War Battlefield podcast. You just heard from Democracy Now! David Sirota, working class, will be deeply harmed by Biden's big win on debt ceiling. A lot of people are frustrated and upset with Joe Biden, and they should be. I'm not here to defend what he did. I am here to offer a little bit of clarity on what we must now do. I am not a fan of anything that he did in that agreement that he made. That that bill that he signed into law. It reeks of the Democratic Party for the last 40 plus years. After Reagan won, the Democratic Party has fallen all over themselves to try and win back those Democrats who became Reagan Democrats. They have tried every which way they could
to become more corporatist and semi-more conservative than the Republicans. And Joe Biden has been there every step of the way. What word did he use? Concession-heavy bill is the new Democratic formula of punishing the poor in rewarding the rich. Again, something that Joe Biden has been there for every step of the way. The man literally just signed into existence the very bill that historians will write lost him the 2024 election. 100 years from now, assuming we're still here, historians will write that Joseph R. Biden, who is trying to capture the FDR mold, and the reality is he ain't no FDR. Joseph R. Biden was handed a choice. That choice being, either he refused to compromise with the fascist elements rising in the United States, refusing to give in to the demands to injure the least among these, to injure the poor, who had been consistently under attack by conservatives and by conservative Democrats for the past 40 years. He had the opportunity to say, no, not no more. I am standing here as Scranton Joe for the average person, and I will not let you force me to injure these people. We're going to duke this thing out. And I'm going to invoke the 14th Amendment. He had that opportunity, but yet, the writers in 2123 were right. And yet, just as we saw when in Germany, the party supposedly representing the opposition failed to rise to the occasion and instead gave in to the fascists. This depressed turnout in the next national election, allowing the Republicans, the fascists, to sweep into office, take back the presidency, control both the House and the Senate, and begin to implement a more authoritarian platform than they had previously. And thus America slid into fascism. Some of you rolled your eyes. You really have no clue. And I didn't have a clue how bad it was until I read and heard and I realized Joe Biden literally just made an agreement to kneecap multiple constituencies which he needs to win in 2024. including college-age kids. Who are becoming more active throughout the country. Maybe that's his plan. He wants to get more conservative Democrats elected. Well, I have bad news for Mr. Biden. This isn't the 1990s anymore. I know you may think it is. Judging by 2020's Democratic convention, you may literally still think it is. I think a lot of people in the upper echelons of the Democratic Party, far too old, they believe it's still the 1990s. My man, you're not getting conservatives that are Democrats. You're going to get conservatives who are fascists and Republicans. People are not going to the polls to pull D no matter who. They're not doing it. Blue no matter who is dead. It's dead. We've been doing that for 40 years. And all we do is keep losing. And I know fascism, black folks been living with fascism for a long time. Welcome, white people. Welcome. But if you think people are going to compromise their morals, their values, to stave off fascism, you don't know history. And right now, Joseph R. Biden is playing with history. This is the type of thing that is noted 1,000 years in the future as the straw that broke the camel's back, that pushed a society on edge that could have gone one way or the other, could have gone deeper into democracy or deeper into fascism. It pushes them towards fascism. And you all think right now, I don't get it. No, I get it. Oh, I get it. See, because if this was the only thing, if this was the only thing, I'd be like, okay, well, you know, it's bad. But, you know, Joseph Biden has not really screwed the lower class. But he has. The man who's Scranton Joe, all about unions, signs legislation to basically castrate a union right when it was about to strike at an opportune time. In any other Western European country, everyone understands that's when you strike. You don't wait to a time period when it's going to be great for the public. First and foremost, the public's never going to think a strike that deals with transportation is going to be great, because Americans, for some reason, have been absolutely, and I say that tongue in cheek, some reason, have been propagandized into believing that strikes and unions are bad. But he castrated them and then tried to explain it away. I'd go into more, but the point of this episode is not to just beat up on Joe Biden. As much as I want to. And look, he's done some good stuff. But as much as I want to spend the time beating up on him, I actually want to use this for something constructive. Because here's the thing. People are going to be frustrated. People are going to be angry. And they have every right to be. People are going to be grumbling about not voting for him. And I think that's okay. I believe it's healthy for you to be talking about not voting for Joe Biden after this. Now, for those of you who are hardcore Democrats who are like, what are you talking about? You're advocating the slide into fascism. Look at the length of this podcast. And take a breath. It is fine to talk about not voting for Joe Biden. It's fine, because Lord knows, I'm thinking, am I really going to vote for this effer again? This dude who just made my loans, my student loans, jack up because he was trying to please the Republicans? Do I really want to vote for this guy? We are still, and this is what he's counting on, we're still a year and what, 5 months away from national elections? He's counting on this to have blown over. That's what he's counting on. Here's the thing, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you don't let him forget this. I want you to buy, I either print out a news article about it or buy a newspaper and clip the article, and I want you to put it somewhere where you have to look at it every day. I know, the people who are very Democrat are like, what are you talking about? Oh my God, you're going to get him. Again, calm down. Breathe a little bit. I want y'all to put it somewhere where you got to look at it every day. And in fact, I want you to get a couple of articles. Not only just this one, maybe a few others that Joe Biden did that pissed you off. Write somewhere where you got to look at it every day. You can't help it. It's going to be right there. And then, I want you to print out a couple of articles, maybe more than a couple, of some good things he did. And put it right there, too. But make sure those couple describing things that he did that pissed you off, like, they're eye level. You don't got to look up. You don't got to look down. As soon as you look, boom, they're right there. Why? Why? I want you to go and I want you to vote for him in 2024. Oh, yeah, I do. I do. But see, this isn't just, oh, well, vote for Joe Biden because he's a Democrat. No. Vote for Joe Biden. And then you know what else you're going to do? You're going to work your butt off in between now and then to get a progressive on the ballot for Congress. I'd say Senate, too, but that's a little bit harder, but definitely for Congress. When you vote Joe Biden back as president, I would love to see a Congress that is 40 or 50 seats Democrat-led, and the majority of the Democrats being progressive. I would love to see the Congress so progressive that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez can walk up to the Senate, backhand Mitch McConnell, and tell him to get her some coffee. And all he can do is just slink away. Because that's how many progressives will be in Congress. And maybe even a few more in the Senate. But the Congress, so heavy with progressives, that there ain't nothing the Republicans can do. See, you got two choices right now, y'all. You got two choices. And I hate to tell you, but progressives have been really, really, really good with choosing one of these choices. And, okay, maybe not progressives, but a lot of Americans have been really good with choosing one of these choices. And yet they're wondering why things keep getting worse. It's because you keep choosing one of these choices. The two choices are this. You can vote, or you can sit home and complain. Now, I had a father and a mother who would say, if you going to sit home and complain, even though you didn't do anything, and you had the opportunity to do something, then one, you a coward, and two, shut up. Shut your mouth. You ain't got no right to complain because you did nothing. But you want to complain about it? You knew that there was something you could do, but you did nothing? Shut up. You can't complain about nothing. Now, here's the difference between the average American and conservatives. Whereas the average American says, well, if I'm not getting my way, I'm just not going to vote. You know what the conservatives have done over the last 50 years? In fact, over 50 years? Go back to 1960. People thought I'm Not a Crook was going to win in 1960. He didn't. Kennedy came through and beat him like the old saying says. Beat him with an ugly stick, boy. Send him packing. People thought literally Nixon was going to win in 60. Beat him. 64 come around. They had a crazy candidate. And by the way, speaking, very quick plug. I will be sometime later on this year releasing a full reading of the 1964 Republican platform with commentary. 64, Goldwater, Lyndon B. Johnson beats him horribly. Horribly. Almost got arrested. That's how bad he beat him. It was rough. But the conservatives, especially the crazy end of the conservative line, didn't give up. Now, they had an assist in 1968. They had a couple of assists, including the death of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. But their guy got in. When Watergate took him down and the Democrats swept in, they didn't give up again. Their new man was Reagan. It took them, 5 years? And finally, boom, Reagan is in with a similar landslide as LBJ? I mean, granted, we know some shady stuff was going on back then right now, which, by the way, I have a book which was written in the 1980s and suggested in the book that Reagan actually, there was some fraud with vote counting, vote tampering and stuff. But either way. So they had the presidency, but they didn't have the Congress. It took them another 13 years of getting beaten and coming back. The average American who wants things to get better, they get beaten once and they go home and they stay there. The average conservative gets beaten, goes home, strategizes, and comes back for another round. You want to be mad at Joe Biden? I feel ya. But don't let your anger cloud your judgment. Because if Trump or DeSantis, or I really don't think it's going to be anyone but Trump or DeSantis, gets into office, ladies and gentlemen, the things that Joe Biden might do that you get angry about pales in comparison to what these idiots will do with more power. And especially if the Republicans are successful with their gerrymandering and all the other tricks that they're pulling to control the Senate and the House of Representatives in 2024. Because they know after 2024, the numbers are not going to be on their side. So if they pull these dirty tricks too many times, especially in 26, 28, people are going to know that it's not legitimate. And that's going to put America in a whole nother basket of problems. You can't allow this to cloud your judgment. You need to get progressives elected. First, you have to get them into the primaries. Second, get them through the primaries so they become the nominee. Third, organize to get them elected. Organize so that when Joseph R. Biden is sworn in 2025, he's looking at a 40-plus Democratic-controlled Congress with over 100 of them being true progressives. True progressives. So no matter if, what's his name, Hakeem Jeffries gets in with his shiny suit, man, and those of you, especially black folks, I don't know if you remember this, but Diddy, years ago, put out an album that was pretty awful, but there was this skit on it. I think it came out in 2001, the summer of 2001, might have been 2002, but either way, It had that one song, number one, on it, which was such a weird song, but there was a skit on the CD, and every time when I think about Hakeem Jeffries, I think about this skit. It was Shiny Suit Man, and it was just crazy, but the man's too clean, and when he smiles, I don't see good things in that smile. So, even if they elect Hakeem Jeffries, he is going to be beholden not to the powerful, not to the money interest, but to the progressives, because they will be the most powerful. Not because there's fake progressives, but because there's real progressives. We are at a moment, ladies and gentlemen, and I've mentioned this before, where it's time for the generations to take the keys away from the elders. It is. Now, for those of you who might say, oh, well, no, you're talking violence. No. No, take the keys simply means it's time to take power away from the older generation so we can implement some things that they're clearly not going to do. You don't have to do this violently. They're older people, for Christ's sake. You could do it non-violently, and you can do it at the ballot box. It is time that we mobilize ourselves to make things better. Because we're waiting on them to get the message, and it's not working. In fact, they seem allergic to the idea of making things better. Save people like Bernie Sanders, obviously. But think about that generation. They literally have ostracized and isolated people like Bernie Sanders. So the people who actually made the 60s a reality. Sure, we celebrate a few of them, John Lewis being among them, rest in peace, elder. But they are celebrated for what they did in the past, and don't bring that stuff to the future, or the present, should I say. Don't bring it to the present. So they're literally celebrated for being radical in the past, but now we don't need that radicalism today. We need to isolate that. We don't need people getting too radical. We don't need people getting too much like the 60s. We need that to be isolated. We need it to be set aside. That's what that generation, the baby boomers, have done with their greatest radical minds. They have isolated them in some instances, institutionalized them, not just via jail, but put them in institutions that were going to constrict their radicalism. In other instances, they've allowed them to ascend, but they keep them away from the public eye, because they're fearful of what might happen if people get that true revolutionary spirit, that true revolutionary fire that these people still have left in their belly. Because they remember what they were fighting for. They remember why they were fighting. They remember the enemies of true freedom. And they remember what freedom is. They remember what freedom is, which is something that I think from a generational standpoint, we don't talk about. What was freedom to the generation before the baby boomers? What was freedom for the baby boomers? What were freedom for generation, I think, X? What was freedom for the millennials? And now for generation E and generation iGen, or the iGeners, who they call Alpha, I guess. Anyway. Let's vote Joe Biden in 2025, but let's also send a whole lot of progressives right there along with him to keep his butt honest. Now, how are we going to do it? How are we going to do it? Now, the things that I'm about to talk about, these are not my ideas. These are things that I've seen other people do that work. Some states are literally trying to stop folks from doing some of these things because they work so well. So I'm going to talk about how you get people out to vote. First and foremost, obviously, getting people to register to vote is something that needs to happen. So if you can go door to door, you can knock on people's door, say, hey, look, you know, are you registered to vote? Would you like to get registered? Yada, yada, yada. Get people registered. That's one. Two, discuss the issues with them. Discuss the issues with them. It helps if you have a handout, small booklet with 10 or 20 issues in it, small paragraph of that issue, what needs to be done, booyah. Very simple and very easy to do. Very easy to do and cost effective. You don't have to have a ton of money. A couple of thousand dollars will get you, you know, a few thousand, if not over 10,000 of those small booklets. Get these people educated on why they need to be politically active. Then, the harder part, get them to know the candidates. Now, once upon a time, you could hand people a booklet with the candidates, what they stand for, but mostly people just go to the internet and see. So what I find is helpful is if you can get people's information, a candidate's information, and you can distribute it either through PDF or through a long form picture, and you can line them up literally with the other candidates to show people who believes in what, right? And then once that's done, and by the way, you can still hand out booklets to, you know, to especially to older people, because older people tend to like the booklets to look at and, you know, okay, well, this candidate is here, this candidate is here. And then the hard part, getting people out to vote. There are studies that's been done that suggest that it takes folks 3 to 4 reminders to get out to vote. 3 to 4 reminders, especially people who are busy. 3 to 4 reminders. So one, get their phone numbers, cell phones, or regular phones. Call them a couple of weeks or a month before the election. Call them a couple of weeks before the election. Call them the week of the election. Let them know what's coming up. Even call them if you got it the night before. Text them if you can. Text them if you can. Now, when you're calling them, just don't call them to tell them that the election's coming up. Ask them, are you going to need a ride? Obviously, if you're going to ask them if you're going to, do you need a ride, you might organize a pickup carousel. You know, get people with cars, people with vans who are willing to actually go scoop people up, drop them off, pick them up, drop them off at their homes. That takes some organization. That takes some coordination. But it can be done. But it can be done. And it should be done. Some places are making it very difficult to, you know, give people food and water directly when they're waiting for to go in and vote, which is funny because they're making it hard for people to give them food and water at the same time while they're passing legislation to increase waiting times, even though that's not what the legislation say it's doing, but that's what it ultimately does. So how you get around that is simple. Well, sort of simple. You could do a couple of things. You could do a couple of things. One, when people are being dropped off, you know, when you're doing your carousel, people get off the bus, people get out of the van, people get out of the car, take a couple of bottles of water with you. Take a couple of things to eat with you, you know. And then if they want, purely, I mean, if they want, they can pass them out, you know. And somebody's like, yo, can I get some water? Absolutely, you know, because we humans, so we don't mind sharing. But boom, that's one way you could do it. The other way you could do it is just break the law. But I didn't say that. And I didn't mean that. You should never break the law. And I'm kidding, really. You should not break the law. Even though that law is stupid and it falls under the category of what Dr. King used to talk about when he said just and unjust laws. That is an unjust law made, created specifically to make it more difficult to vote. So, you know, there's other creative ways, which I'm not going to get into here, but I've seen some things. Anyway, pool your money together. You know, if you pull together a community group, small, it doesn't even have to be that large. It could be, you know, 5 to 10 people. If you pull together a group that's going to coordinate some of this stuff, pool a little bit of money together, rent a van, go around picking people up, dropping them off, picking people up, dropping them off, and go door to door, ask for donations, things like that. So you can actually be that force that gets people to the polls. Now, obviously, you also want to look up to see if there's groups in your area that are doing this type of work and partner with them if you can. But look, the only way things are going to change is if we get up and we make things happen. You hear me? If we make things happen. And the only way that things are going to happen is if we say enough is enough. We're tired of being tired. We are going to fight. That's it. You don't like that Joe Biden made this agreement, made this concession agreement, which he's trying to act like is a win, which isn't a win? That's great. Keep that anger. Keep that fire. And go and replace some of his colleagues in the Congress with some progressive people. If you do that and you replace enough of them, Joe Biden's going to get the hint really, really, really quickly, especially when he sees an avalanche of young people who are pissed off at him for increasing the amount of money that they have to pay for their student loans. Well, okay, I guess not a ton of young people are going to be on the hook for that, but people in my age range and, you know, down to the 30s and maybe the mid-20s, once when he sees a sea of people pissed off at that, voting for progressives to knock out conservative Democrats, that's going to change his mind on a few things rather rapidly. Why? Because Joe Biden is a politician. He is a politician. And at the end of the day, he's got a legacy to look out for. And this, if he pulls this in his last term, his legacy is going to be garbage. His legacy is going to be garbage. But I will tell you also, because I want to be truthful with y'all, the other reason why I am saying, look, just vote for this man, is because I'm not stupid. If the Republicans gain the White House, I am pretty sure that they are going to, one, try to fix it so that the Republicans get the White House no matter what in 2028. And I'm not sure exactly how they do it, but they're pretty crafty. So if there's a way, they'll figure it out. Two, they're just going to declare themselves president for however many terms they want to declare themselves president. And if you think that that cannot, will not, will never happen, how many times do you think in history, especially the last 70, 80 years, did a society say, that's never going to happen? I mean, there is not going to be a military takeover of the... Why is there gunshots coming from the presidential ballot? Oh, and why? What is that blood-soaked body-shaped thing coming out the front door? Wait, who's that guy up there? Crap. Yeah, how many times has that happened? Again, don't let your anger cloud your judgment. Don't let your anger cloud your judgment. There are ways to fight back, but you just can't sit home. You just can't sit home. I know it feels good. I stuck it to the man. No, you didn't. You stuck it to yourself. Because the man's going to be fine. The man's got money. The man's got a ton of money and a big house and people that love him and support him and security that's going to keep him safe. But you just made life a lot harder for yourself. Instead of getting up and voting and organizing to vote out the people who are continuously making these bad decisions, You voted to let in folks who not only create bad decisions and make bad decisions, but perpetually do so. Don't let your anger cloud your judgment. Joe Biden has to pay for this, and he will, when he's faced with a 40-plus Democratic-controlled Congress in 2025, with over 100 of them being true progressives. That is when he's going to pay. That is when he's going to have to say, oops, I kind of, okay, messed up a little bit. Maybe I shouldn't have done that whole thing with the whole student loan thing. Yeah. I wonder what's the first piece of legislation they're going to. Medicare for All. Well, I don't really believe in it, but they're talking about if I veto it, they're just going to override it because they have the votes. I may want to sign this. Another infrastructure bill. Didn't we just do a once in a gen? Well, you know, I'm vetoing it. Oh, they overrode it. I'm feeling not that powerful right now. Wow. Cutting the Pentagon budget. Oh, you're crazy. I'm vetoing. They overrode that too? Ugh. Is there anything I can really do? Or should I just... All right, fine. I'll sign it. I don't even know what it is. I'll just... I'm tired of getting my vetoes overrode. I'll just sign it. That is where you want him. That's where you want him. You want him so frustrated because his vetoes keep getting overturned because Hakeem Jeffries is too afraid of the Progressive Caucus and the squad, which is now 40 people deep. That even he's saying, you know something, I'm Speaker of the House, I'm the HNIC, but Jayapal, what you need me to do? Because I'm tired of y'all beating me up in the media, and I got money and everything, but I ain't built for this. What do you need me to do? Look, y'all, I know, this is funny for me, I ain't gonna play, but y'all need to really understand this, okay? There's a generational shift about to take place, and the only thing that's going to prolong the baby boomers and people like Joe Biden, who isn't a baby boomer, but right before the baby boomers, that the only thing that can prolong their stay in power is you doing nothing. That's it. That's the only thing that can prolong their stay in power is you sitting home for 2024 and doing nothing. If you organize, if you get set up right, ladies and gentlemen, the generational shift will happen in 2024 and everything will reset. Because I'm going to tell you, here's the thing. Here's the thing that nobody wants to tell you, but it is the truth. In the next 7 years, between now and 2030, there is going to be a generational shift. It's coming. And what I mean by generational shift is you are going to see a lot of new progressive, younger, between Generation X, which is, man, I was talking to somebody who was born in like 73, and he's about to be 50, and it just like blew my mind, like, holy crap. Wow. He's about to be 50. So you're going to have folks that are part of Generation X, which was a very small generation, about 15 years or so. You're going to have people in Generation X, Millennials, Generation E, which y'all know I don't call them Generation Zs. They're not Zoomers to me. They are the generation of equilibrium and equality. So they're Generation E for me. You're going to have those folks taking over governments. And as we move into the first 5 years of the 2030s, you're going to have more of that happening. More of it. The generational shift is going to happen. The question is, how fast? You make that decision. You make the choice. How fast is that generational shift going to occur? You make that decision. If you set out in 2024, it is possible that the generational shift doesn't come in 2026, but in 2028. No, it could come in 2026. Because by 2026, the number of people 18 to 25 who can vote are going to be, it's going to, it's the between Generation E and the millennials, if the millennials show up, because that's a big problem with us, is we don't show up. The numbers, though, will position those two generations to really wield political power. And that is why the conservatives and the religious right are putting a lot of money and effort into trying to dilute those generations with propaganda that confuses them, with libertarianism as the forefront, the foremost ideology of saving America. But it don't matter. The numbers will be there, and the polls suggest that the percentage of progressive-minded people in both of those generations are beyond the 50% mark. So if people vote, the control is there. I mean, especially when you talk about Generation E, progressive-minded and straight-up radicals. You're talking about a generation that's looking at somewhere between 60 and 75% of progressives and radicals. That's a watershed type of numbers. All they have to do is show up and vote. Now, obviously people need something to vote for. Well, here's the thing, ladies and gentlemen. Again, you got two choices. You can wait for the Democrats to write you a platform that you like, or you write a platform yourself. Hate the conservatives all you want. The conservatives, especially the neocons, wrote the contract with America as the platform that they would run on. They didn't care what the Republican National Committee was saying. They wrote the contract with America as their way of expressing their values. That's what you need to do. That's what you need to do. Where is the progressive equivalent of Mandate for Leadership written by the Heritage Foundation back in the late 70s for Ronald Reagan? Where is the progressive equivalent of the Cato Handbook on Policy? Where are they? Where are they? I'll tell you where. Nowhere. There's actually a book that the New Democrats put out, and I'm looking through my bookshelf quickly trying to locate it. The book was published, I think, by the Brookings Institution. And it was an attempt to create, there it is. It was an attempt to create an answer to what the Heritage Foundation had put together. Mandate for Leadership book. The book title, which, I'm sorry, I said the Brookings Institution, it wasn't. It was the Progressive Policy Institution. The book title was The Mandate for Change. And it's a pitiful old thing. I mean, it's not terrible. It is sort of terrible. I mean, I literally just opened it up to page 217, and chapter 10 is Replacing Welfare with Work, by Will Marshall and Elaine Ciulla, C-I-U-L-L-A, Comerick. I don't know who either of those are. But this was supposed to be for the Clinton administration. And by the way, replacing welfare with work. Sound familiar? It should. Quickly, again, though, where is the progressive equivalent of this? Let me just quickly read through the contents of this, and then I think I'm going to call it a day here. Chapter 1, Enterprise Economics, Rebuilding the American Economy by Robert J. Shapiro in Doug Ross. Oh, that name sounds familiar. Number 2, Enterprise Economics and the Federal Budget, Robert J. Shapiro. Number 3, Enterprise Economics on the Front Lines, Empowering Firms and Workers to Win. Ugh, these people are so... Ugh. By Doug Ross. Enterprise Economics. Notice that phrase never caught on. Enterprise Economics. Enterprise Economics. First time I'm ever hearing that. Number 4, Strategic Success in the Global Economy by D. Holly Hammonds. 5, A Progressive Plan for Affordable Universal Healthcare, Jeremy D. Rosner. 5, Educating America, A New Compact for Opportunity and Citizenship, Tim Carter, Robert Lerman, and Charles Moskowitz. I don't know. I've not heard of any of these people. Number 7, A Progressive Family Policy for the 1990s. Elaine Kamarek and William A. Galston. I think I've heard of William A. Galston. Number 8, Safer Streets and Neighborhoods, Ed Kilgore. Heard of Ed Kilgore. Number 9, The Greening of the Market, Making the Polluter Pay. Oh, the Polluter Pay, sorry. Robert Stavins and Thomas Grumbly. Number 11, because we already went through number 10, A New Federal Comeback, Sorting Out Washington's Proper Role, Dave Osborne. Heard that name too. Number 12, Reinventing Government, Creating an Entrepreneurial Federal Establishment. Whoa, David Osborne. That one I might need to read. 13, U.S. Global Leadership for Democracy, Will Marshall. Oh, Will Marshall. Number 14, The Transition, Reasserting Presidential Leadership, William A. Galston and Elaine Kamarek. Where is the progressive equivalent? Where is it? Time to show up, y'all. Time to show up. It's no longer time to just put out these one-off plans that nobody reads. Take all of those one-off plans, put them together in a book, 1,000 pages, 1,200 pages, whatever, and publish it. That's what's needed now. One place where people could go and find it. By the way, for those of you who do not know, I think this is the only, Mandate for Change, I believe, only had one volume. And the volume, small little book, was about 388 pages. And the most of it was policy prescriptions and, you know, information. But here's the thing. The Mandate for Leadership had 5 books. I'm looking at all of them. I own them all. And these books were not tiny. Okay, I'm sorry. The 5th book was tiny. But, of course, the 5th book was tiny. It was published in, I think, 2005. And by that time, the Republicans and the Heritage Foundation had pretty much gotten everything that they wanted. So, of course, it was tiny. There was no more to really say. The Progressive Policy Institution, did it get anything it wanted? And all it did was put out one book. Generation change is coming, guys. A generation worth of change is coming. And there's going to be a battle to stop it. That is the frightening part. You ready? Questions, comments, concerns, you know you can always write me. Go to radio, the number 4, ALL.net. Radio, the number 4, ALL.net. Click on today's show. You can, there's a search bar to the right. You type in Class War Battlefield Podcast. Type in, and then hit enter. I was going to say type in the show number, but you don't really have to do that. Hit enter and click the show. It has a contact, the contributor, right there. You can't miss it. Hit it. You can send me an email directly. I love hearing from you guys. If you want to support the work that I'm doing, CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast, Cash App, PayPal, $2, $5, $10, $20, $30, $50, whatever you could do. Help me out. Help keep this thing flowing. Again, love hearing from you guys. Big up to Dr. Obashaka. To all the podcasts that I normally list out. I'm over 50 minutes right now, so I'm out. Peace.
There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alive.